is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, hoop heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish home machine. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Asim Rastogi from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com.
Reframing failures is not letting them dwell on failing at a new thing that they're doing, not letting them dwell on the negative of a new skill that they're acquiring, but highlighting the good things that they did, highlighting the fact that you didn't get it this time, but we're still standing here. There's still 10 minutes on the clock, and I don't have a full sweat on right now, so we're going to go again. And it doesn't matter. Nobody's watching. Nobody cares. It's just you and me and the basketball.
Ito Singer just completed his third season as an assistant coach for the UNC Greensboro women's basketball program. Singer previously served as the head coach of the NAI school Fisher College from 2016 to 2017, the head girls basketball coach for the Mass Huskies AAU program from 2015 to 2016, and as the director of operations at UMass Lowell for the 2014-2015 season. In 2013, Singer was the women's basketball assistant coach at Nichols College in Dudley, Massachusetts. He also served as the head coach of Heschel High School in New York from 2009 to 2012. In June of 2011, he founded an elite basketball skills development service, Ito Basketball, that has conducted over 100 skill clinics in New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. Singer played professional basketball from 1996 until 2003 for Maccabi Tel Aviv in Israel, as well as a few other teams. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com. or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, The Green Light, Courtside Culture, and our team-focused NBA pods, Cavalier Central, Knuck If You Buck, 305 Culture, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, spanning the Spurs, LA Hoops, Daily Thunder, the Wizards Hoops Analyst, Lakers Fast Break, and At the Buzzer. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Grab your notebook before you listen to this episode with Ido Singer, women's basketball assistant coach at UNC Greensboro. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the assistant women's basketball coach at the University of North Carolina Greensboro, Ido Singer. Ido, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm fired up to be on right now.
We are excited to have you on. You actually had me on your podcast that you had One Last Thought and asked me to share a little bit of wisdom with your audience. So I'm hopeful that you will enjoy being on this podcast as much as I enjoyed being on yours back. I guess it was probably, over a year ago, I think, that we did that. But excited to have you on and learn about all the different things that you've been able to do in the game, both as a player and as a coach. You've had many different levels, experience in different countries, and I think you're going to have a lot of wisdom to share with our audience. So I'm looking forward to being able to dig in with you. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Give us an idea of what your first experiences with the game of basketball were like and how you came to fall in love with the game.
All right, that's a good question. I actually got a chance to tell this story to the person that got me into basketball. So I'm originally from Israel. So I was born and raised over there. I'm in my early 40s. So it's a while back. And I was walking around. I was young. I think I was about 7 or 8 years old. And I was walking around and someone had dropped a Patrick Ewing rookie card on the floor, on the ground. And I looked at it and it looked like it was coming out of a silver bullet, you know, him really long, getting ready to dunk. And I said, wow, that is interesting to me. And so I started really digging into basketball. And I asked my mom to take me to this basketball class that was happening at the local Y that we had near my house. And I always like to tell this story. My first claim to fame was walking onto to a basketball court in the middle of a random practice when I was 7 years old, receiving a pass, taking about 15 steps without a dribble and throwing the ball over the backboard. So, but that was all prompted by me picking up a Patrick Ewing card. So fast forward 20-something years, I was working as a bouncer in a New York bar in between going to school in New York and then picking up my first coaching job. And I see Patrick Ewing and his buddy walking down the street. So I completely leave my post and I run across the street. I'm all out of breath because I haven't been, you know, doing anything in years. But I come up to him and I shake his hand and I tell him this quick little story. And he lights up. And it was absolutely one of the coolest moments of my life, being able to tell Patrick Ewing himself that I picked up his rookie card when I was 7 years old, and he was my inspiration for playing basketball. So I guess that's kind of my story of falling in love with the game.
Not a bad inspiration. Patrick Ewing back in the day, when you think, it's kind of amazing when you look back at how basketball has changed and the fact that Patrick Ewing spent 4 years as a player at Georgetown, and we all felt like we knew him almost personally by the time he got to the NBA. You had seen him and been with him for so long. And it's one of the things I think that has made college basketball, especially on the men's side, so much different today than it was back then, where you kind of had these teams of freshmen would come in and there was the Ewing era Georgetown Hoyas, and there was the Chris Mullen era St. John's Redmen, and there was the Pearl Washington era Syracuse Orangemen, and there was the Michael Jordan, James Worthy, North Carolina Tar Heels, and just all these different iterations of these teams that now in the college game you just don't have. And I know that when I think back to that time of college basketball, I think back fondly on those years of being a college basketball fan. It's interesting that just, again, the randomness of it being a Patrick Ewing card and then the randomness of you seeing him on the streets of New York City and getting an opportunity to share that with him. That's a really cool story. All right, so you go from there and you get inspired. And obviously your first steps out onto the basketball court as a 7-year-old weren't necessarily successful, other than
getting you indoctrinated into the game and probably just the beginning of getting you hooked on it. So as you start to dig deeper into basketball, what does it look like growing up in Israel in terms of your exposure to the game and how you went about learning the game of basketball as a player?
It was fun. I mean, Israel is, if you're looking at Eastern Standard Time, Israel is 7 hours ahead. So anytime there was a basketball game on West Coast or East Coast, West Coast was much easier. It would usually be about 1 a.m. Israel time. And East Coast was 4 a.m. Israel time. So I would be waking up in the middle of the night to watch NBA games because you couldn't watch it back then. It wasn't, on demand. There was no YouTube. You'd have to either wake up and watch it at 4 a.m. before you go to school and get in trouble with your parents and just, ask for forgiveness better than permission, or you just don't watch it. And so you have to read it on, in the paper. So I fell in love with studying the game live, with, getting up early in the morning and sacrificing something for my personal development, for my love of the game. And that really brews something inside me, something that's really deep, a deep connection with this game as a kid. And in Israel, it's the second biggest sport after soccer. So from a very young age, I was playing and I was doing all kinds of things. I was playing outdoors. I was playing on basketball teams. I was just playing in school. It was just nonstop, constant basketball. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I just really loved to train. I loved to get better. I knew right away I didn't have a lot of talent. I wasn't the most athletic person. I always joke around that I could never really jump over an iPad. So,
there's another thing you and I have in common, I'm right there with you, buddy.
Mike always jokes at basketball camp that he's going to, I always joke that he's going to dunk it and then he jumps and touches the bottom of the net. So that's pretty much what Mike does.
That's about as high as I can get. So
Mike, I don't have to jump to touch the bottom of the net, but that's okay.
There you go.
I just loved working hard at something that I fell in love with. And so that started at a very young age. And it just kept growing from there. All my friends played basketball, and I just started getting better and better and moving up the ranks as I was getting older. And it just became much more than fun. It became an obsession. It became something that I just wanted to get better at every day. I was living that old adage that if you're the best player on the basketball court, you got to find the new basketball court. So I was always driving around trying to find a new competition. I played a lot of 3-on-3 when I had some time after school. And as soon as I was done with homework, sometimes even before I did homework, I would be out there playing and running scenarios from the game that I just saw last night. I was dribbling back and I was posting up Akeem Olajuwon. I was trying to get him with the dream shake and I would practice it over and over and over again. And in my head, I'm counting back and I'm imagining that I'm on a basketball court in the NBA. And it was an obsession, but I loved it so much. And I just couldn't get enough of it.
What was the balance between playing and you practicing the game on your own? How much time were you spending just on a court or in a gym by yourself working on your skills versus how much time were you spending playing pickup basketball?
I played pickup basketball every day for at least 2 to 3 hours. When I was in high school was when I was playing the most intense schedule for basketball. So I was playing on the youth team. So every basketball club in Israel, and it's the same way in Europe, most clubs like that, every professional club will have their feeder clubs everywhere, anywhere from the grassroots level and all the way up to the like U18. So you just go up the ranks as you get older. And if you're good enough, you stay with that club or you move up to better clubs. I was fortunate enough to be at the youth club for Maccabi Tel Aviv, which was the number one team. And so my schedule became crazy when I was 16 years old because I was playing on that youth club. I was playing for my high school team. I was playing for like a pre-national team. And I was playing for the reserves for the pro team. So I was on four different levels plus doing 2 to 3 hours of 3-on-3 a day. And I was that crazy kid. So here's a story of how I fell in love with hard work. And my focus to this day is footwork I'm big on it. I'm a big believer in it. And the way I worked on it was I knew that there were only 24 hours a day. I wasn't that smart, but I figured that one out. And I figured that I couldn't work on it all day, every day, as much as I wanted to. So I found a creative way to get my footwork reps in. And I used to always walk to school, and it would take me about 15 minutes. But I decided that I was going to rep my footwork on the way to school. So Monday and Wednesday, on the way to school, I would do front pivots only. So it took me close to 45 minutes, but I would literally front pivot one way, front pivot the other way to get to school.
That's
Monday,
awesome.
Wednesday. Yeah. So Monday, Wednesday was front pivot and then back pivots on the way back, or reverse pivot or inside pivot, whatever, you know, some coaches call it different ways. And then Tuesday, Thursday was combination day. And then Friday was free for all. I would just do some crazy stuff and I would try and do my latest moves and things like that. And kids would look at me and laugh. But a year later, when I was 17 years old, signing my first professional contract, it wasn't funny anymore. But I got hundreds and hundreds of hours of repetition of my footwork before I even got to school. So I became so much better than most of the kids in my area, in my age group, that much quicker, just because I found a creative way to get my reps in.
That's really a cool story. I don't think I've ever, obviously you've heard the Pistol Pete Maravich story of him carrying a basketball everywhere he went and dribbling and riding his bike and all those kinds of things. I have never heard of anybody pivoting their way to school. So that's a new one. That's a new one on me. That's a good one. I'm going to have to share that with some of my players, maybe even my own kids, see if I can convince them to maybe I can get them to at least pivot through the living room. I don't know if I can get them to pivot all the way to school. That's a really good story. I think it's interesting. Tell us a little bit more about the European club system and how that impacts in your mind player development. Because one of the things that we hear all the time is that our system of basketball here in the United States, it's backwards. There's too many games. There's not enough training. We just there's obviously a better way. Europe is better fundamentally than we are here in the U.S. So just maybe give us a little bit of a background on what the European, what the Israeli system was like when you were coming through it, and then how it compares in your mind to the way we bring players up here in the United States.
I think, first of all, I think there's so much more talent here in America than there is anywhere else in the world.
Right.
So I feel like the European model has no other choice but to do it this way, because if you don't double down on skill development, you will never be able to play with the big boys in America. So I think it's out of necessity. It's also something that they truly believe in. And so with the clubs that I grew up with, you'd have an A team and a B team for the same age level. And so if you're on the B team, you're really fighting hard to get to the A team, because when you're associated with your pro club, you're never going to get a contract if you're on the B team. So you're always trying to move up, move up, move up. There's constant skill work. There are two a days every day. You would come in the morning, you do a lot of skill work with your coaches, and then you go to school. If you're lucky enough, you'll be able to do that early in the morning if your club has the resources. Thankfully, Maccabi had him, so I was able to go in there early, sometimes 6 a.m., and just get a quick workout till 7:30, go home, take a quick shower, get to my 8:30 class in the morning. And then when you're done with that, I go home, eat some lunch, go, take a little nap, and at 4 o'clock, I'd be out there again training. And so you do two a days. If your club has the resources, but if not, you're still working hard, and it's not so much of a games focus. It's more of a skill development focus. They're really trying to isolate what you need to work on, what they feel you're going to be, what's going to be successful at the next level, and they just double down on it. And games are secondary. There's no AAU. I'm not sure if that's the way it is right now, but there's definitely no AAU when I was growing up. And it was all about, you train 5 days a week, you play 2 days a week, if you're lucky, or maybe once a week, and that's it. And there's never another game. That's it.
were you living at home at this point? And were there players that were part of the club that were away from home?
No, the club is kind of central to the middle of Israel. It's central. It's you know, middle of Israel. It's Tel Aviv. So people, players from the area, and sometimes from maybe an hour away, would just commute to come in and train. But yeah, I was living at home.
Gotcha. All right. So as you move up each one of the levels, and obviously that funnel gets smaller the higher you go, and you get to eventually the level where you're going to have an opportunity to play professionally. What does that look like? What's the feeling when you sign that first professional contract? Maybe take me through what that was like for you personally, and then maybe what it was like for your family. What kind of conversations were you having with your parents at that point? And just give me an idea of what that first iteration of becoming a professional player was like.
Well, I had a great support system. My parents were always supportive. I always had shoes on my feet. And even though we didn't really have money, we're not coming from any kind of money or anything like that, but I always had shoes on my feet. And I was always at practice on time, and they figured out ways to make sure that me and my sister would have everything we needed to be successful. So, you know, all the support, all the glory goes to them first for that support. But as soon as I signed that contract, I looked left and I looked right, and I'm like, is this for real? Is somebody really going to pay me to do this? Because I would have done this for free. I mean, I know it's a tremendous opportunity, and I knew it at the time. I was just humbled by it. It was some sort of validation to the fact that hard work does pay off, but it's also a reminder that now you're one of so many good players. And I never really considered myself a good player. I just considered myself a harder worker than you or whoever it is that is in front of me. I was just going to outwork everyone. So I never really felt like I've arrived. I just felt like, oh no, I have not arrived. I just have to work 3 or 4 times as hard right now, because everybody I'm going to be facing is going to be better than me. There's no doubt. So I had to figure out ways to be better, to work harder, to find ways to be creative, to find ways to be quicker, and figure out ways to beat the better players that I'm going to face day in and day out. It was humbling, but it was also a wake-up call, and it was more of a reality check.
Do you use that lesson with players that you've coached over the course of your coaching career and talk to them about how hard work maybe helped you to overcome what your perception was a lack of maybe natural athletic ability, for lack of a better way of saying it? Do you use that lesson from your own life with your players that you've coached over the course of your career?
All the time. Every day. Every single workout. I keep telling them that I had no business playing professional basketball. None. There were thousands of kids that had better talent than me, that had better physical abilities than me. Everything. They would have it on me 10 times. But they didn't outwork me. They never really had the commitment and dedication that I had, and they were not willing to do what it takes. And I think that's one of the biggest separators among people who are successful at any field and any level is, are you actually willing to do what it takes? Once you figure out what it means to be successful and what it actually takes, are you really willing to put in that kind of work and to put in that kind of dedication and to do it day in and day out? And I was ready to do it, and I was excited and fired up to do it. And I think once people get to a certain level, if they don't have that kind of fire, they're just not long for that profession. And so I use that with my players all the time. It's like, you have talent. You have more talent right now than I've ever had. But I'm telling you right now, if you know, like that old Will Smith story, if we both get on a treadmill, I'm going to die before I get off that treadmill. You're not going to outwork me. Yep. Even at 40, 41 years old, you're just not going to do it. So yeah, I use that all the time.
Yeah, it's a great lesson. And it's one that I think as coaches, that when you share that with your players, it hopefully – it hits home for them. And when you were talking about that and sharing that, I come back to just thinking about the fact that you have, when you think about college basketball and you think about the players that you coach on the women's side or players that you know, are on the men's side, either way, and you think about the hard work and the dedication and the level of commitment that you have to have in order to be a college basketball player, whether that's at the Division I level or it's the Division II or Division III or NAI, whatever level it is, the amount of hard work and effort that you have to put in order to be successful is a huge commitment. And I think about a lot of the players that you see at the youth level on the AAU circuit, you think about high school players. And a lot of times I look at some of the players that, you know, you see their parents and they're, you know, they want their kid to play basketball in college and they spend so much money and time and energy and effort to achieve this goal. And then part of you wonders if they're not wired the way you were, which is to try to get the maximum out of your ability. And I think I was wired. I never pivoted my way to school, but I was wired in a very similar way to the way that you were wired, Ito. And, you know, I look at it and I say, you know, what got me to where I was able to get in the game as a player was because of my hard work and my dedication, all those things. And yet I know there were days when I was a college basketball player that I was like, man, this is really tough. If I didn't love this, there were days where I thought, ooh, I don't know if I'd put up with this if I didn't really and truly love it. And I think for players that are out there, it's important to remember that if you want to maximize your ability, you have to put in that hard work and you have to love it. And those are the people who end up getting to the top of, as you said, any profession, not just in basketball, but in whatever that you choose to do. So you put in all that hard work, you put in all that dedication, you get an opportunity to play for the top level club at Maccabi. And how do you, what are some of your best memories as a player? Do one or two things stand out when you think back to your time as a professional basketball player? What's one or two of your favorite memories?
Yeah, well, let me set the record straight. I did not get a chance to play a lot for that club. I was a glorified bench sitter. I sat there. I did a lot of practice with them. I would be the kid that got in 10 seconds at the end of the game and get a little taste of this and a little taste of that. And I appreciated it so much because I got a chance to be around such great players and work with such great coaches. I mean, we were talking off air on, you know, about the Cavs, and my point that I was trying to finish before we got disconnected was I was following the Cavs back then because their head coach was David Blatt, who coached me. And so that was my little connection to Cleveland, and that was the kind of level of coaching that I was around. So I was appreciative, you know, I appreciated so much that opportunity to sit on that bench and to just listen to timeouts. And I wish I was more tuned in as a coach and less as a player, because I would have gained so much more to be able to apply that right now as a coach. But still, I've been influenced so much by being around such great players and such great coaching. But to answer your question, one of my favorite memories was in one of those summers, in my first summer playing professionally, I was with Maccabi, and we were doing a practice game against Bologna. And there was this young kid, I think you've heard of him. He was 18 at the time. Manu Ginobili was his name, who was playing for Bologna. He was considered the best, and obviously I'm joking. We all know Manu. But he was playing for Bologna at the time, and It was just a practice game. It was camp, and we just finished on a practice game against them, and they were really good. We were really good too, and I never really expected to get off the bench at all. But the game was kind of out of hand at the end. I think they were beating us by a good 15, 16 points, and it was about 20 seconds left. So I check in, and we kind of figured out their rotations, and I know Manu's sub is sitting there at the table waiting to check in right after me. But the game is live. I'm guarding one of their post players, and I get Manu on a switch. So I'm laughing because I remember that so vividly. I get Manu on a switch. He looks me up and down. He has a live dribble. He takes a dribble back, and he's asking to clear. And I go, oh, boy. So here I am. I'm still wet behind the ears. I know I'm trying to check the best player, the best young player in Europe. And you guys all know about the sham god, right?
So yep, absolutely.
I think that originated somewhere in Europe back in the 80s. But I don't know. I don't want to get into that argument. Sham god is going to find me and get really mad. So so he looks at me, and he's left-handed. So he's dribbling with his right hand. And I know the scouting report says if he's with his right hand, he's going to cross over to the left hand, and he's going to either pull up or drive. So I'm getting ready for the crossover. And I knew I wasn't supposed to lean too much. So he's dribbling with his right. He leans in with his left shoulder, and he sham gods with his left hand. And I go flying to the floor. And then he pulls up right next to me, knocks it down, of course, looks down, and he goes, nice play, eh? And he runs back. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that was really nice. So that is hands down one of the coolest stories and things that I will take away with me. But yeah, for a glorified 22nd player, I think that was pretty cool.
That's very cool to be able to get out onto the floor with players of that caliber and to have memories of playing against guys like that. And I know during my playing career, I had opportunity to play against some guys that played in the NBA. And it's just, you know, again, you try to measure yourself if you have – you know, if you have some pride and some ego, you try to measure yourself against those guys. And, you know, I'll still have people that occasionally ask me, my own kids will sometimes say, Dad, how come you never played in the NBA? And I'll always say, well, you know, I wasn't good enough. And it ultimately, that's really just what it comes down to. You just, you know, you try to maximize the ability that you have. And then you look at some of the abilities that NBA players and guys that I was around that I played against or that I knew. And those guys just have an unbelievable wealth of talent, and then they maximize that talent. And, you know, you talked about how hard you worked and you maximized what talent you had. Just imagine if you had been blessed with more talent, what you could have done. And that's what guys who are in the NBA that are blessed with that talent, and then they also combine that with the work ethic and the determination and everything else that you had. And that's really what sets them apart and makes them so special. Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season, and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit SnapRaise.com, and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time. I want to ask you, this is a question that is, I'm just curious for my own, I don't know if anybody in our audience is going to care about this question.
One, I love this.
One ounce, but on a personal level, being from Cleveland, when the Cavs hired David Blatt, he was hired pre-LeBron returning to the Cavs with the idea that David Blatt was going to coach a rebuilding young team. And then obviously LeBron decides to come back to Cleveland and that all changes. And David Blatt's reputation coming over from Israel to the United States was that this guy was a tremendous coach, X's and O's, being able to relate personality-wise. And yet he got here and for whatever reason didn't mesh with LeBron and obviously didn't last nearly as long as many people thought he would. When they hired him, I'm always a fan of hiring coaches who are new as opposed to somebody who's already had six jobs in the NBA and you're just bringing them back and you already know what they are. So I was excited when David Blatt got hired simply because I thought he could bring some new things and some innovation. So tell me and the 10 other people who care about David Blatt and what kind of coach he was and what you enjoyed about being a player underneath him.
He is incredibly smart. I mean, the guy played for Pete Carril. So speaking about somebody who we're talking about somebody who learned the Princeton offense from the originator of the Princeton offense.
Right.
And then took it in all of his experiences and was able to modify that to the modern player back in the early 2000s at the highest levels of Europe. So he is incredibly smart. He's got a million plays in his back pocket. He has wrinkles on top of the wrinkles that, you know, lead into other wrinkles. He can out X and O any coach in Europe, and he is really good. He has a really good feel for the game. He makes really good adjustments. They're on point. I mean, I am not qualified enough to even assess how he does what he does. I mean, I wouldn't even try. What I will say, though, when they hired him, I was a little afraid that it wasn't going to work, not because he wasn't a good enough coach, not at all, but because he is very demanding. He doesn't round any corners. You know, he's just like, he knows what success looks like. He coaches players really hard. It works in Europe because in Europe, the coach is, you know, God, basically. And especially when you reach that level of coaching, when he's one of the top 10 coaches in Europe, what he says goes. But when you go to the NBA, the players are in control. And so if you have enough players turn against you because they don't like to be coached this hard, it becomes an issue. And I don't think for one second LeBron walks into that locker room and David Blatt is looking down. I think he looks him straight in the eyes and he is trying to let him know respectfully that, you know, we are here to win together, but this is my team. And I just did not have a good feeling about that. But I think he's one of the best to ever do it in Europe. I think he would be a great fit in the NBA as an assistant coach. But as a head coach, I just don't think it would be a really good fit. I think Messina was really good as an assistant coach in the NBA, and he would have been a really good head coach because he's not that intense. Kokoschkov over at the Suns a couple years ago is intense, very good X's and O's guy. Really good with the guys, but just I think the intense coaches from Europe, just it's not a good fit with the modern NBA player. So that was my worry, but he is phenomenal. He's one of the best ever.
It's so interesting to hear you say and describe how different guys can have success in different places. Because when I think about what makes a great coach, I think a lot of times it's matching up the coach with the right level or the right league or the right gender, whatever it might be, where you might have a coach who is a tremendous coach as a junior varsity basketball coach. And maybe they wouldn't be very good working at the college level, or maybe they wouldn't be very good working with third graders, but at their level, they are an outstanding coach. And I think there are some coaches, again, that are just built for the college game, or better built for the pro game, or better built for a particular type of player. And the great coaches obviously all make adjustments, but I do think that we all have our strengths and our weaknesses and the places that can best utilize our talent. Just like a coach's job is to put players in the best position to be able to utilize their talent. I think in a lot of cases, and when you think about David Blatt, that's really what, when I think back to him being here in Cleveland, I think about a guy who, again, had a tremendous reputation in Europe coming over here. And as you said, it just, for whatever reason, didn't work. It wasn't the right fit for him. It's not that he wasn't a great coach. It was just, it wasn't the right fit for him. And I think that that's something interesting when we think about ourselves as coaches in our career and trying to find the right pathway. You know, you have some coaches who have been tremendous high school coaches who move up to the college ranks and continue to have success. You have other guys who are like, I would never want to move up to the college ranks. I love being a high school coach, and this is the level where I'm meant to be. And I'm sure, as you know, there are great, great coaches at every level of basketball. It does not matter. You can find tremendous middle school coaches. You can find tremendous high school coaches, college coaches at all levels. And it's just interesting to me that you find your niche as a coach, and you find what, you know, what groups or what age levels that you like to work with. And that allows you to maximize your ability as a coach without any question. And you've obviously had some different experiences at different places. How, when did coaching come on your radar? Because you mentioned that while you were playing that you wish you had maybe spent more time thinking about the game from a coaching perspective. So that maybe leads me to believe that coaching really didn't get on your radar until you started to see the end of your playing career on the horizon. So just talk to us about how you came to coaching.
Yeah. Also, for to the last point, I think if your name is Brad Stevens, you could coach at any level and just be phenomenal. I think
this guy
can coach. He can coach bobsledding and still be just as amazing. So,
yeah.
But for me, I would say when I was done playing, and I was done at an early age, I was about 23 years old. I just realized I was too short for my position, and I was just not good enough to play in the NBA. And if I wasn't good enough to play in the NBA, I just didn't want to play anymore. And maybe it's a little petty and silly, but I just felt out of love with playing the game, a little disillusioned. So decided to move to the States and go to school. And I moved to San Diego. I liked the weather. I liked the place. And I went to school there for a couple of years. And then I moved to New York, and I was going to be closer to family. And I was just kind of drifting a little aimlessly and didn't really do anything with basketball for a few years. And so when I was closer to 30 years old, I just realized something was missing in my life, and I wasn't really going in the direction that I wanted to go. I just wasn't loving going to work every day. And so I was thinking, and I said, you know, I really love basketball. Obviously, I can't play anymore. I think coaching is really important, and I think it's a great job. And I've always enjoyed some of the best coaches that I was around, so why not give that a shot? And I just started coaching at the lowest levels, you know, coaching with different small club teams and coached middle school girls. My first year of coaching, it was amazing. You know, big city, Big Apple City Champions of 2013 or something like that. I don't know. You know, that was my introduction to coaching, and that was really fun. And then started coaching JV boys and JV girls, and just working at these low levels. I remember just, you know, going around to people's backyards and just coaching their kids. I enjoyed it. It was something I did every day, working with players at all levels, and it just ignited this fire. And as soon as I started really building practice plans and mentoring players and seeing them succeed, I knew this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I didn't know that I wanted to do it in college. I just knew that I wanted to do this as a profession. So that's where it started. It started in people's basements and backyards, and just working my way from there.
How did you learn what you were going to teach as a coach? When you go into somebody's backyard or you go into their driveway to work with them, how were you putting together the workouts that you were doing with those players? Was it just from your playing experience and things that you had done? Were you at that point starting to look for coaching mentors, reading? How were you getting the things that you were putting together for your players? Where was that coming from?
I think all of the above, but I think when you're working with kids, nobody's a forward. Everyone's a guard, or at least everyone should be a guard. Nobody should be forced to play with their back to the basket until they're in high school and they're 6'9", you know? And even then, I would argue they still need to know how to shoot, pass, and dribble. So everyone's a guard. And so I've never really had experience with working on so many guard skills. I was always a post. I mean, I'm 6'5" on a good day when my back is straight and, you know, it doesn't hurt. So, and I was playing the post. I was playing against 6'9", 6'10", 6'11". So I was always a post player. And so I had to learn different techniques. I had to go and research and read and, you know, read books and just watch videos and get those DVDs from Championship Productions at the time and get different and talk to different coaches. What are you working on? So I had to learn a lot of different ways to teach, but I think, and, you know, kind of circling back to what I said about footwork, I think the basic, movements in basketball are the same, whether or not you're a post player, point guard. I think there are only 5 things you can do with your feet in basketball. And if you can master those 5 things, everything else you do with your feet is just combinations and creativity. But I always challenge players to go on YouTube and give me the craziest basketball move, and I can almost guarantee that I can prove that it's a combination of these five things. And so I had to really learn how to deliver an effective skill development practice to younger kids who don't have the skill level, and they're just learning how to dribble. They're just learning how to pass, and they're just learning how to run sometimes, you know? So it was a lot of learning. It's a lot of trying to get better so I can be better for other kids. So it was just, again, humbling myself and going through the process of learning a skill and learning how to teach it.
All right. So let me break this down for you, or let me ask you to break it down. If I'm going to, because we have some youth coaches that are part of our audience. If I'm a youth coach and I have, let's say I have a team of 8, 9, 10 year olds that are not super experienced, and I want to teach them some basic footwork, what are some things that you would recommend to a youth coach to institute into their practice to help their players work on their footwork?
I would say, so if this is, let's say it's a rudimentary level and you're not just teaching them how to pass, shoot, or dribble, I would say focus on the front pivot and on the drop step. So I think there's so much versatility in the front pivot. So a front pivot could be turning to shoot, just catching the ball in the post, making a front pivot, turning around and shooting. I know it's a contested shot. It's not a great shot if you look at analytics, but the footwork remains the same. I think it's the same thing for Steph Curry to come off of a wide pin down from the corner, catch the ball on the wing, front pivot, 1-2 shot. The footwork is exactly the same. So it goes from the lowest levels to the highest levels, and it goes all over the court. You catch the ball from an inbound, you're facing the baseline passer, and you front pivot to turn and start dribbling. So it doesn't have to be on offense near the basket or at the three-point line. It's a very basic basic skill. You front pivot to pass. You sometimes front pivot to chase somebody off of a screen. So it translates to everywhere. The drop step is the same thing. You drop step to basically the score in the post. You drop step to defensive slide. So I would focus on very basic footwork. And I just always love to show how the basic footwork is the base level for everything. If you can master front pivot, reverse pivot, drop step, and then two counters, and you can really just teach those things to be consistent with players, then they can translate it to any place on the court, and they can just multiply their skills. And I would say just focus on footwork, focus on balance. That's it.
I think that athleticism piece is always interesting to me when you talk about having good balance. And I think one of the things that kids miss out on today because they don't get as much time for free play, especially not outside the way that, at least the way that I grew up. And when I mean free play, I'm not even just talking about just pick up basketball. I'm just talking about running around the neighborhood playing tag or chasing my neighbors, you know, over a fence or climbing trees or all those things where I feel like I learned some of those balance things and some of those athletic things and how to land and how to pull myself up a branch to get up into a tree or climb myself over a fence that I think that kids today, and this is one of the reasons why I think we've seen an explosion in sort of the speed, strength, agility market for coaches in that area, because kids just don't get the same experiences that kids 15, 20, 30 years ago got of running around the neighborhood and developing their athleticism in that way. And I think that by talking about footwork, by talking about balance, by giving kids an opportunity to practice that, I think we really are in a lot of ways kind of replacing what they might have gotten naturally back back in the past. Do you see that? What's your thought on that?
You know, I always use the analogy of keep away when I teach back pivots or reverse pivots. I always say, do you have a younger sibling? What happens when you have a toy in your hands or you used to have a toy in your hands and they were trying to take it from you? You just play keep away. Keep away is a back pivot. So you've done that when you were 2 and 3 years old. You stand on one leg, you yank it from your sibling or your friend, and you pivot with the other foot to get distance
right.
from them.
Right.
So it's in us. But to your point, I agree. I think we overstructure everything as coaches, as adults. We don't give them enough free play. And I think beyond basketball, beyond skills, athletic skills, I think by not letting them go out there and handle things with their friends. And I know the world is different. It's more dangerous. We can keep eyes on them and we can do all that. But giving them the opportunity to free play with their neighbors, with their friends, teaches them negotiation skills, teaches them problem solving skills, teaches them creativity. And that's so important. And what we did this offseason with UNCG, with our team, is we went and we just concluded that we did about 5 weeks of this. Once a week, we would just come together because we would do individuals one-on-one, two-on-two. We would come together and we would do three-on-three. And we'd give them three different starting scenarios. Maybe it's a wide pin down, and then we play from there. And we just give them a limit on dribbles, and that's it. 10 minutes, you have to call your own fouls. You have to, you know, you have to shoot the ball. If you're arguing the call, you got to shoot for it. And they started just, it became intense. They started coming up with creative things. And they were teaching us things as we were watching film on that. And I'm like, we don't do enough of this. We don't give them the credit for being creative. We overstructure it. We tell them how things are instead of telling them, these are the things you need to focus on. And everything else is up to you. You are creative. You got to come up with ideas. And when we challenge them to do that, but we give them a strong framework to work out of, we can be really amazed by what they can do.
I think the creativity piece is something that really strikes me as an interesting concept to try to figure out. How do we instill more of that in our players? And I think that the challenge is that when you were growing up, or when I was growing up, and you were playing 3-on-3 pickup basketball back in Israel, or when I was on my driveway when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, or when I was at the playground when I was 14, 15 years old, there was nobody there watching me who was trying to critique my game. Now, there was people that I was playing with who were older than me that would point things out and say, hey, you should do this, or, you know, you have to fit in and play a role. If you're playing pickup basketball and you're 15 and you're playing with college players and adults and you start chucking up a bunch of shots, you're not going to be playing much longer. So you have to figure out how to play a role. But the point is that there's no parent, there's no coach that's there that's inhibiting you from trying new things and from being creative. And I know one of the things that I always used to love to do is if I was playing in a game with better players, my role was different. And if I was playing in a game with players who maybe weren't as good as me, then I would challenge myself and say, hey, I'm only going to drive with my left hand, or I'm only going to shoot jump shots in this game, or this game I'm not allowed to take any shots outside the paint. And I would put these little, again, constraints or challenges on myself. And that always, I think, helped me to develop my all-around game and my creativity. And players today, every game that they play, at least here in the U.S., games that they play, and this is on both the men's and women's side of the game, they're playing in AAU basketball or travel basketball where they're with a team, they have a coach, their mom and dad are in the stands, there's a referee with a whistle, there's a scoreboard. And so they're always, it's always performance based, and there's never an opportunity for it to be process based, like what you were describing that you guys just finished up doing, where you're giving kids an opportunity to just go out there and experiment. And so I'm always heartened when I hear coaches, again, at all levels, giving their players an opportunity to kind of figure things out for themselves. Because to me, that's the best way to develop intuitive basketball players. And intuitive basketball players, in my mind, are the best basketball players.
I agree. And I think the problem is it's because it's the end here is the result, not the process. So creativity comes from confidence. You don't have confidence if everything you're doing is scrutinized against the result, not against development. So if we're working on a skill in practice, and then you go out on AAU weekend and you play five games, and every time you try it, it doesn't work for you, then you stop doing it because you're reframing success or failure based on the result in the game, not against the fact that you had the guts to try it. And that should be celebrated. So when I teach the footwork stuff, kids will get it mixed up all the time. And it doesn't matter if it's the college level or AAU level or whatever it is. They'll mix up a front pivot and a back pivot sometimes. And I always speed them up. When I see them standing there, I yell at them to go faster. Not in a mean way, but in a way to speed them up because I don't want them thinking. So they'll mess it up and they'll stop. And I always tell them, don't stop. Keep going. You didn't do the front pivot I asked you to do. You did a back pivot. That's awesome. You just got one rep of a back pivot. Good for you. Now go to the next one and do a front pivot. And don't stop. It's just reframing what success is. To me, success is moving on to the next rep without losing confidence in what you are doing. It's not the fact that you messed up what I asked you to do. You just did something I didn't ask you to do. Good for you. Move on. So I think it's our job to be less intense with them and not tie everything into a result. Tie it to a process. Reframe what they feel is failure and tell them that you didn't fail. You just succeeded at something else. And it's not going to waste. You just got a rep in something else. That's fine. Let's go again.
How big of a challenge is that at the college level where clearly you're judged based on not just the process and not just development, but ultimately you're judged by what happens on the scoreboard and what your one loss record is. So how do you balance developing that creativity and focusing on the process while still keeping in mind that ultimately you're going to be judged by those external results? How do you balance that as a coaching staff?
It is definitely a challenge. As an assistant coach, my job as I see it is to A, support my head coach and do everything I can to make her successful. And that's the result of working hard with the players and getting them to be as good as they can be on the floor. So that falls again into me selling them on the fact that this is a process. I understand we don't have all the time in the world, but if you jump in with 2 feet with me, I'm going to jump in 2 feet with you, and we're going to get through this together. And I will guarantee that I will make you better if you're willing to put in the work and you're willing to experiment. So it's a process of building trust with the players you work with. I wasn't always successful developing skills with some players, and it's not always because of them. It's not always because of their lack of work. Sometimes I misread what their needs are or what their skills are. So it's from both of us, but we need to be able to jump in together and say, this is honestly where I, as the coach, feel you can be. This is where I think your ceiling is if you work hard. This is my plan to get you there. What are the skills you want to work on? And what are you willing to commit to get there? And if we can be on the same page, we both work hard, I think the end result will be a player that develops quickly, a player that is engaged, and I think everyone benefits. I think the disconnect comes from players who say they want something but don't really put in the work, or coaches that overpromise and underdeliver. I try to underpromise and overdeliver. So like I said, I'll jump in with the player if they're willing to jump in. I'm not going to drag you into the gym. I'm going to encourage you to do it. And if you really want to succeed and you want to get better, we'll get better together. And we're just going to work hard at it. So I just think everyone wins when you have that kind of attitude.
And you obviously have to have those honest conversations with players where you're telling them exactly where they are, where you think they can go, and then what they need to improve upon, what they need to work on in order to get to that level. But part of being able to do that, in my experiences, is that you have to build that relationship with a kid before you can have that completely honest conversation. So how long, when a player first comes into the program, how long does it take you to build that type of rapport? And obviously through recruiting, you may already have a rapport with the players before they come in, but it's still different once you get them on campus and you're with them on a daily basis. So just talk about maybe the relationship building piece and then how that helps you to be able to develop them more fully on the court.
You know, Mike Nabors from Arkansas had a great quote, and he said that they stay 18 years old, we just keep getting older and older. So the age gap is always there. And so I'm starting to feel it sometimes in some situations where, you know, you want to build those relationships, but they listen to some kind of music that I've never heard of. And, you know, Big Baby and Little Baby and all these things. There's like 17 different rappers named Baby, and I don't know any of them. So, you know, I try to kind of figure out where my lane is, and I'm staying in my lane. My way of building relationships is by, you know, being a father figure. I'm a father myself. I have three kids. And so I want to make sure that their parents understand that I'm going to treat them as close as I can to my own kids, in the sense that I'm going to care about them. I'm going to make sure that they're physically and emotionally okay to the best of my ability. I'm going to be honest with them, but I'm also going to be hard on them, and I'm going to demand that they do what they need to do, and they're going to be accountable for it because they deserve that. So that's the base of where I start. And then from there, like you said, we can't just demand things from them without trust being there. So the way I like to build trust is I like to work hard. So I want to work hard for them. I'm going to be there, and I'm going to work hard in developing their skills. I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to encourage them all the time. I'm going to try and reframe their failures, which is something I'm really big on. I'm going to make them feel good as much as I can when they leave that gym after a workout, because they worked hard and they will feel like they actually took a step forward. And I celebrate so much of what they do all the time, whether it's on social media or I'll make a big deal out of something that they accomplished. So if, you know, we have a 6'3" post player. She came into the program and she was more of a defensive minded player. She still is. She wasn't very skilled offensively. So we're working on a lot of different things right now, but what we're narrowing it down to is one or two post moves and her ability to shoot a 15-foot jumper. So the other day we're doing 3-on-3 and she couldn't go to the post move that we're trying to do, which is just a drop step to the middle, drop step to the baseline, taking your defender in and then taking her to the baseline. She kept going to this runner that we don't really work on that much because it was easier to do. And if she fumbled the ball, it would be, you know, it would be acceptable because she had so much defense on her. But that wasn't acceptable to me. So we just kept pounding, hey, go to your drop step, go to your drop step, go to your counter. And when she did that the other day, and she did that against a really good defender and had her fly by and she went on an up and under, I was screaming up and down, running around like a crazy person. Let's go. And you just hype them and you make them feel good. And that's what I do. If you do the smallest thing that we work on, if you even attempt to do the littlest thing that we work on, I am going to make you feel like $1 million, and I'm going to embarrass you doing that because I'm one of those people. But I think they know it comes out of love and it comes out of caring. So this is how I pour into players. This is how I try and build trust. I'm there for them. I care for them. I demand some things from them, and then I celebrate the crap out of them when they do well, and I try and reframe their failures. I'm just there for them. So that's kind of my process of doing it. It doesn't always work with every player. Some players I didn't connect with, unfortunately, but that's just the only honest way I know how to do it.
Explain what you mean by reframing their failures. I know you talked about it briefly a minute or two ago, but just give us a little bit more of a deep dive into what you mean by reframing failure.
I don't let them dwell in their failure. So if a player is working on a new skill, so again, I'll go back to my 6'3". We call her Big Baby. So if she takes a jump shot, and we just started working on her 15-foot jump shot, so she's not allowed to be upset when she misses shots. If she takes a jump shot and it's an air ball and she looks down, I'll just look at her funny. I'm like, why? No, it's a new skill. I don't care. I'm not even watching your shot. I'm watching your feet. I'm watching your elbow. I'm watching your snap, your wrist. That's all I care about. And when she shoots, I stand behind her. And I will say good when I feel like the release is good, regardless of the result. So I'm trying to frame the process prior to the ball hitting the rim, because she needs to hear what I think and connect it to what it feels like to do the right thing. So when she misses a shot and she gets upset, I keep reminding her that I said that was a good shot when it left your hand. So you can't be upset when the shot didn't go through the hoop. It's not going to go through the hoop all the time. Michael Jordan didn't have 50% field goal percentage. Who are you? So you can't be upset. You're going to be lucky to have a 40% of your jump shots from 15 feet hit in a game. You should have 50-something percent around the ring because you're 6'3" and you're a beast. But for jump shots, you should be happy with 4 out of 10. And you're just learning this skill. So reframing failures is not letting them dwell on failing at a new thing that they're doing, not letting them dwell on the negative of a new skill that they're acquiring, but highlighting the good things that they did, highlighting the fact that you didn't get it this time, but we're still standing here. There's still 10 minutes on the clock, and I don't have a full sweat on right now, so we're going to go again. And it doesn't matter. Nobody's watching. Nobody cares. It's just you and me and the basketball. That's it. So, you know, just you can't dwell on these things. You just got to keep going. Nobody's going to care. And I'll go back to that story of the footwork stuff. When people were looking at me funny and thought I was a complete crazy person, and then nobody laughed when I signed my first contract. So all your failures, every time you look stupid when you do this and it doesn't work for you, doesn't matter, because people don't know and people don't care. And the ones who are laughing at you when you're making a mistake are the ones that don't have the guts to step forward and try it themselves. So it's just a matter of just reminding them that they're in the gym, they're doing good things, and it's just another day and we have another rep, always.
I love that. And it's one of the things that when I'm working with players that I really do try to do is look at what they're doing and not look at the result. And you talked about it when you're saying, well, the shot didn't go in, but you're still using the correct form, or your footwork was still good and it was a good rep, even though the ball didn't go through the basket. And sometimes as coaches, that's hard to do. And I think you have to be very intentional about going into a workout or a practice setting and making sure that that is the approach that you're taking. So as you said, you don't discourage players. You want to keep them thinking positively, especially if they're trying to add things to their game or you're trying to make a change in something that they do, which can be frustrating and difficult for players to do. And if all they're looking at is the results of whether the ball goes in the basket or whether they're able to perfectly execute the move, it's going to be really difficult for them to, it's going to be really easy for them to get frustrated. And if you do it the other way, I think you give players a much greater opportunity for success without question. Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com. All right, I want to ask you about your role as an assistant coach. Tell us a little bit about what you think makes for a good assistant coach. So somebody who's out there who's early in their career, who is maybe looking to get an assistant coaching job at the college level, what are some characteristics, some things that you think are important as an assistant coach?
I think empathy is really big. I don't think it's talked about enough. And empathy in the sense that you have to really care about other people's success. And you have to really care about other people first. You're there serving other people. This is not your program. You are there to make the head coach look good. You are there to help them with anything and everything they need. You are there to foresee issues before they happen, hopefully, and solve them. I had a head coach that once told me that the best head coaches are the ones that don't hear about any of the problems. Problems are solved before they're even problems. So the best assistants to head coaches will do these things. So your empathy needs to be there. You need to understand it's not about you. You need to have a small ego and hard work and being able to do those little things and not expect to get praise for them. I love you know, working for my head coach right now because she will praise her staff all the time. And we always say in our program, don't brag on yourself. Let other people brag on you. It's a part of our core values. One of them is humility. So we always talk about that. We don't have to say anything about ourselves as assistant coaches at UNCG because our head coach and the other assistant coaches will always mention something about your hard work. And so that's a big reason why I love this staff. Our head coach is phenomenal. She's the best person I have ever worked for. Tremendous basketball mind, but 10 times better of a person than she is a coach. And that says a lot for somebody who's been coach of the year and worked for Tara Vanderveer and had Gino as her position coach. She comes from a very successful basketball tree. But I think what I've learned from her and what I take as an assistant coach wherever I go, it has to be about others first and foremost. What can you do to help the players? What can you do to help the rest of the staff? And what can you do for your head coach? And then if you do all those things, people will appreciate you. And if you honestly care about other people's success first, it's funny how success finds you. It's just one of those funny things in life.
Absolutely. I think that sometimes we take that for granted of understanding kind of what our role is. And I know I was a longtime assistant coach at the high school level, and you have to figure out what it is that you can do for your head coach, because ultimately, again, as you said, the program belongs to someone else and your job is to make their job easier when you're an assistant. Now, you've had a couple opportunities to be a head coach, both at the high school level and at the college level. So tell us a little bit about your experiences as a head coach and how that has benefited you in your current role as an assistant, just what you learned as a head coach in terms of dealing with your staff, and then how you kind of maybe look at it differently than you did previously. So just give us an idea of how being a head coach helped you in your current role as an assistant.
So the biggest thing I learned as a head coach is that I love being an assistant coach. seriously though, being a head coach is a tremendous responsibility. Someone once said, I can't remember who it is, but someone once said that being an assistant coach is about making suggestions and being a head coach is about making life-changing decisions. So assistant coaches make all kinds of suggestions all the time because it's easy to make suggestions when you're not the one that has to actually make the final decision. I think the best assistant coaches don't make suggestions that they haven't A, researched, and B, have 10 different reasons why they would work. And then C, maybe have a B plan for when that doesn't work. So it's much easier to be an assistant in that sense. I think what being a head coach taught me is that this is serious stuff. We have the lives of not only young, men and women in our hands at very impressionable time in their lives. We're molding lives. We have a relationship with them that they're going to remember for the rest of their lives. And it has to be a positive one. We cannot be scarring people for life just because we have something that we're going through and we're putting them through the same thing. The responsibility as a head coach is tremendous. And, it just taught me responsibility. It taught me that every decision I make influences the lives of the people that I make it for and their families. And there's so much that is on the line for every little decision that you make. And so that's why I kind of joked at the beginning that it taught me I wanted to be an assistant coach. I'm not afraid of making decisions, but I feel that I'm better served right now helping our head coach make those decisions. I feel that my experience is there, and I really enjoy being in a supporting role. It is really tough being a head coach. I mean, my hat's off to anybody that does that day in and day out, knowing what the job is.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question that the transition from an assistant coach to being a head coach, it's different. It's a different feel when your name is attached to the record, when your name is the one that is publicly associated with the performance of the team. And as an assistant coach, you can do a lot of the fun stuff of coaching. And as you described, you get to get out on the floor and work with players, and you can make suggestions. You can do all those things. And then you can sort of take that step back that the head coach does not have the opportunity to be able to do. And that puts a lot of pressure on them. And I think when you talk about what a head coach is looking for in an assistant, I think that word empathy that you shared with the audience is 100% spot on, that you have to be empathetic to what your head coach is going through, and you have to look for ways to provide value to them and to try to make their lives easier, because it certainly is a challenge day in and day out. And I don't care if you're at the high school level, you're at the college level, you're at the pro level. If you're a head coach, there's a lot on your plate. There's a lot of pressure on you. And if you have a good staff, they can help to make your job much, much easier. How about the difference between coaching at the high school level versus coaching at the college level? And then also maybe address some of the differences in coaching boys versus girls, men versus women. So just give us your thoughts on coaching at the high school versus college level, and then your thoughts on coaching males versus coaching females.
I loved coaching at the high school level. It was some of the best years of my life, and I wish I knew more about coaching when I was at the high school level, because I would have served my team better. I was still learning, still cutting my teeth in this profession. And man, I experimented so much at the high school and middle school level. But I loved it. It was the biggest part of me falling in love with coaching, because it was such a raw relationship. I mean, these kids are going through puberty. They're going through high school, which is hard enough as it is. And then we're putting them on a line for suicides, which I will never do again as a coach, but I used to do then. We're putting them on the line and doing all those things, and there's pressure, and all of a sudden the girls are in the corner watching them, or the boys are in the corner watching the girls. And it's such a raw time in their lives. And I just loved it for everything, for all the hardship and all the good times. So I thought high school was fun. It's also, I mean, obviously the level is much, much lower, but I think it made me a better coach, because I had to figure out ways to make them successful in places that they may not have had any business being on the court and doing different things. So it definitely made me better. I love coaching women. I coached boys a little bit at the high school level, and it was fun. But as soon as I started focusing more on the women's side, for some reason, I just felt a bigger connection. I think it has a lot to do with growing up with women in my house. I mean, my father died when I was 17 years old, and I was the only man in the house with my mom and my sister. And I've always been around women. Even right now, you know, I'm outnumbered. We have three women in the house and me and my three-year-old boy. So we're definitely outnumbered. If you count the dog, there are four females in the house. So I've always been outnumbered, but maybe that's why my connection on the women's side is so strong, is because I've always been around them and I was able to connect. And I think on an emotional level, I'm able to better connect with them. So it just became a natural thing. I feel a connection with the game, but I felt a stronger connection on the women's side. And then transitioning to college, I just love the elevated skill level. But I think what I realized is they're all still kids. They're all still learning. I think, again, with the footwork stuff, it's a very quick thing to humble them with, is to show them five things and show them how they're maybe possibly can get better at them, or they're not doing them well enough, or how they can be better at this, even at the college level where they think that they've arrived. Some of them do. So I just, again, love working with players at all levels. I've enjoyed high school immensely. And when the level became a little higher in college, I still found ways to challenge myself, challenge them. I just, man, I'm just a basketball junkie, and I just love, I can't believe they're paying me to do this. It's unreal.
All right. Where do you go to learn? What are your go-to sources, people, mentors? If you want to get better in your personal life as a coach, as a human being, where do you turn to try to improve yourself?
See, we should have started with that, because this there could be an,
it could be a whole podcast, right?
Yeah, I am not kidding. I'll tell you this. I have over 4,000 titles on an external hard drive of different clinics and things like that, but that's not even the biggest source. So YouTube is an unbelievable resource. And at this point, I have a subscription list, and I'll be happy to share it with any coach that wants to learn about X's and O's, about different philosophy. Anybody that wants to share it, I'll obviously leave my contact info at the end and you can reach out to me. I'll share it with you. But at this point, I'll have anywhere between 20 to 50 different items ping on my YouTube, which I will save into playlists. And there are anything and everything that have to do with basketball clinics, X's and O's, video breakdowns, anything that you can think of, philosophy, interviews, they're all there. So I have this YouTube collection. I also have a list on Twitter that are just X's and O's, different philosophy. You're on there. A lot of other coaches are on there. So I'll have all of these things that I save into my notes, and then I'll put them in other places. It's all categorized. I just go to anywhere and everywhere. I talk to coaches all the time. I watch clinics. I have a list of full games that I'm sitting through right now and just breaking them down, putting different notes to them, trying to learn. I do a lot of European basketball breakdown right now because I just love that game, that style. So I just go anywhere and everywhere. And there are so many free resources out there that, you know, people's heads will spin if they really dug into it. So I'm happy to share all of these different systems that I have and resources with anybody that wants to learn. It's just, there's not enough time.
All right. So that leads to my next question, which is, if I'm an experienced coach, I can feel overwhelmed with all the things that are out there. And if I'm an inexperienced coach, I can only imagine what that feels like. So what advice would you have for somebody when they're looking at video or they're trying to find good things? And obviously you can share specific sources, but let's just say that I'm a coach and I find something that I like. How do you then make sure that you take something that you found, get it onto paper or get it into a file on your computer, and then actually institute it with your players or your team? What's your system from going from seeing something cool that you're like, oh, that's interesting, or oh, that's something that would be cool to try, to actually putting it into practice with your players or your team?
So as an assistant coach, again, I make suggestions.
Right.
I have to critically look at everything that I find and really say, will this work for our personnel? Is this something for UNCG, or is this something for my personal playbook? And it could be for both. I encourage every coach to find. So Kevin Eastman says success leaves footprints, right? So find out what you feel is success. If you're defensive-minded, go study the ones you feel are successful at any level, high school. Oh, my goodness, there are such great high school coaches that run the most amazing creative stuff. Or if it's a college level, if it's Europe, if it's FIBA, if it's NBA, but just at WNBA, be mindful of the level, though, when you're trying to adopt something to your team. But I encourage every coach to figure out what they see as success and then go study those programs, those coaches, those teams. It's not necessarily something you can take to your own team right now because there's such a skill disparity, or maybe, you know, somebody sees a great baseline out of bounds. Well, in the women's game in college, they don't put a defender on the inbounder. They usually have a defender under the basket. So I can see the most amazing baseline out of bounds play. But if the defense is standing on the ball, I'm not going to get the same cut at the basket because there's a defender there. So I can't use it. So it's maybe not for us, but it's for my own playbook. So I encourage every coach to find what it is they feel is good, what kind of success they want to experience, and just build their own playbook, offensively, defensively, philosophy, everything. There are resources to do that. So that's my first thing. Figure out what it is that you want to implement as a coach and start collecting different ideas. You don't have to categorize everything right now and scrutinize everything. Collect. Then for me right now, again, I have to look at it in the lens of what can we do? And if I find something that I feel is interesting and I feel that we can adopt it, then I go and I look at it and I go, okay, this is where I would put this player, that player, this player, that player. And then I go to every assistant coach on our staff or a head coach and everybody on the men's team, and I challenge them to tell me why this wouldn't work. So I try and have them figure out where are the holes in my philosophy. And every time I find a hole, I either try and find a solution for it, and if I can't, that's gone. So I always look for why this wouldn't work. And if I get to a point where I've asked 3 or 4 or 5 different people and they go, no, this actually could work, then I would bring it to my head coach after this whole process. So that's my process. But I would encourage everyone to figure out what they think is good and start collecting ideas and just build your playbook. But yeah, it could get overwhelming. Just know who you are, know what you're looking for, and narrow it down from there. And you're not going to be able to use everything. I mean, we can't run everything Gonzaga runs. I wish we could. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, there is so much out there and so much good stuff that it gets overwhelming fast. And I think, to your point, you have to have a system that works for you, whether that's 3-ring binders old school, whether that's computer files, whether that's some combination of both. I think that when you start to put together and find those things and find those resources that are going to benefit you as a coach, whether you're an assistant, whether you're the head coach, whether you're somebody that's just starting out in the profession or somebody's been in it a long time, every coach eventually develops their own system of how they kind of put things together. And what I'm always curious is, that's why I asked, was just how you go from finding something you like to actually implementing it. Because I think that typically is the challenge, because we'll all go and maybe you go to a clinic or you see a video and you're like, oh yeah, I really like that. And you'll save it or you'll write it down or you'll stick it in a binder. And then 2 weeks later, you kind of forgot because you moved on to the next shiny silvery object that was glittering and you went over to that, you know, you went over to that thing. And now, you know, and that's where I think sometimes coaches get, I don't know, not in trouble, but you know what I'm saying? They sometimes lose out on some of the things that they find. And I just think having a system is really what's super, super important.
And so that's what it is. Yeah, that's what it is. Collect and categorize. And I'm pretty sure, there's some gems in my office that are collecting dust, and I don't know about them because they're printed out and everything I have now is digital. Collect and categorize to the best of your ability and then just go through it. And I'm literally going through every folder that I have of things that I categorized.
Yeah.
And some things I go, what was I thinking? And so that's gone. But you know, you got to collect, categorize, scrutinize.
Yep. I'll do that with a journal. Like I'll write, you know, I'll do some journaling every day, and there'll be times where I'll try to carve out some time to go back and look at what I've written. And sometimes you go back and you're like, oh, you know, what was I thinking there? But at the same time, sometimes you'll go back and you'll say, oh man, that was a great idea. I was super enthusiastic about that. How come I never followed through? And then it just brings you back to something that could end up being important. I know I've done that where I've circled back to ideas that had been laying dormant for a month, 2 months, 6 months. And just by circling back through the journal, I'm able to kind of bring them back to the forefront, and it it does a lot of good for me, both in my professional life and in my personal life, to have those things written down. And journaling's been really something that I've started doing in the last couple of years only, and it's really helped me just as a human being. Forget about as a basketball coach. It's just helped me in my life to, again, get things out of my brain and onto paper where I can go back. And the key is circling back, and I guess that's what that's the point that I'm trying to make here. Before we get out of here, we are coming up close to an hour and a half, Ito, and I want to be respectful of your time, and I want to ask one final question of you, and that is, when you think about what you do day to day and you look forward, I want you to share with our audience the biggest challenge that you see over the next year or two, and then also just share the greatest joy that you get from getting out of bed in the morning and being an assistant coach with the women's program there at UNC Greensboro.
So I'll start with the second part of it. So the biggest joy for me is, again, like I think I've alluded or said, that I cannot believe I'm being paid to do this. I get to go to work technically in my pajamas and go work.
I know the feeling.
Exactly. And then go work with amazing people that I consider friends. And that I'm talking administration all the way down to the people that are on the other side of my wall that, you know, we share an office suite with our staff. And then I get to work for such great young women who are absolutely inspirational. I mean, when all the, the civil unrest happened last year, we had players on our team that were so involved and were able to raise their voice for a cause that they truly believe in. And we all jumped in with both feet and supported them. And we're doing that again this Friday. We're going to go march to downtown and just, you know, speak up and be there shoulder to shoulder with them. So I get to go to work for and with people that I absolutely respect and admire. So that is the biggest thing I cherish about my job. I think one of the challenges that we're going to see in this profession in the next few years is I don't want to be one of those coaches that keeps talking about the transfer portal. I think, again, we're talking about reframing failure. I think it's easy to say that the transfer portal is evil. I think it's harder to appreciate the fact that because of this transfer portal, every coach in the country had a chance to talk and meet with kids and families from all around the world and all around the country, of course, that they would never have had a chance to meet. So I appreciate the opportunity to get to know all these players that we talked to because of the transfer portal and all these families. So that was just really a cool thing that happened. We had no business talking to them, but now we did. But I think one of these things that happens now is kids are less inclined to tough it out, and it's much easier for them to jump ship and listen to bad advice if things don't necessarily work out exactly how they would want to. And obviously we all know that life is going to have its challenges. Things are very often not going to work our way. And it's how we respond to hardship that really matters. It's not how we, go and run the other way. And I know some situations are benefited by this transfer portal. There's some abuse. There's some players that are better suited for other teams, other conferences. I get all that. But the players who are jumping ship because they don't feel like they've gotten enough minutes or they can go somewhere bigger, that's where I think the hardship happens and the challenges will happen over the next couple of years. There are over 1,000 women in the transfer portal right now. And last I checked, there's 357 teams. Seniors don't have to graduate. The math just doesn't work. And a lot of kids are going to step away from full scholarships into nothing. And that's just a shame. I think a lot of kids, if they could do it all over again, would probably reconsider. I just fear that some of the consequences of this new legislation might affect how they're viewing or reframing failure and hardship.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays itself out. And obviously, I think the intent is to, you know, enable players to have more freedom and to give them the opportunity to go and find a better situation. And yet I think there's going to be some ramifications that for both schools and for players that, you know, are unintended and maybe unexpected. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Ito, I just want to give you a chance before we get out of here. Share how people can reach out to you, social media, website, email. And then after you do that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
Sure. So reach out to me on social. So it's the handle is Ito Basketball. So I-D-O and the word basketball. It's kind of like a play on words. I do basketball. It's one of those silly things. So Ito Basketball on Instagram. I recently got out of Facebook, so you might not be able to find me there. But Instagram or Twitter, it's the same. My email is i_singer@uncg.edu. Definitely reach out for anything and everything I can help you with, any resource I can share, any question or anything else you wanted to say or talk about. And if you get a chance to check out the podcast, it's One Last Thought. And it's been sitting dormant a little bit and taking a little bit of a hiatus, but there are plenty of episodes there. It's not basketball related. It's hopefully inspirational and thought-provoking. And very different than a lot of different podcasts in that realm. So if you get a chance to check it out, please check it out.
Absolutely.
And let me know what you think.
You could spend an hour and a half with our podcast, or you can listen to one of Ito's episodes, and you could probably get 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of his in the hour and a half that you spend listening
exactly.
to one of ours.
Oh, yeah.
And it's great. And it's great stuff. When Ito reached out to me to be a part of it, you know, I've taken a listen to a lot of his episodes, and there's a lot of very quick and efficient and very profound life advice. And the people that he's found, as he said, are not just basketball related. There are people from all walks of life who have had tremendous success. So please go and check that out. Reach out to Ito. If you listen to him tonight, you know that he is someone who cares deeply about the game of basketball, loves coaching, and will definitely be a great resource for us here at Hoopheads moving forward. And hopefully you'll take the opportunity to reach out to him and have a basketball conversation or just a conversation about life. And again, Ito, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to join us tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.